The primary cause of those fires in Russia is a severe drought that's also disrupted the grain harvest there. Russia is a huge grain exporter, and this week the country announced it will stop exporting wheat because of low yields. That decision sent wheat prices skyrocketing and has left countries like Egypt, which is the world's largest grain importer, wondering where to turn. It's a scenario that could have come right out of a new book by Evan Fraser and Andrew Remus. It's called Empires of Food: Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. And Evan Fraser joins me now. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Now, you have sort of connected the dots between the decline of great empires, the Roman Empire and the Mayan empires, for example, and then the collapse of their food structures. Can you explain that theory?
In every single historic case that Andrew and I were able to look at, something at some point went wrong with the food system, and the cities then no longer were able to feed themselves, and people floated away.
So what happened in Rome, for example?
Well, what happened in Rome is as the empire expanded, or the republic expanded and turned into the empire, they first of all exploited the soils and caused a lot of soil erosion, which was one of the reasons why they had to go continually expand outward in search of new soil. The second thing that they did, which was a mistake, was that they grew large and dependent on the food that they were able to obtain during a period of time when the climate was relatively nice. It was relatively easy to get good harvests. So those two combination of factors, though, didn't last. So what's called the Roman Warm Period tailed off into a fairly cool 500-600s AD in Europe. And the soil was exploited. And so those two things meant that it was very difficult to keep the surplus food out of the countryside and driven into the cities. And when that stopped, the tax revenue collapsed. It became too expensive to keep the legions going. The merchants no longer were able to move what little wares they did have into the city. And the whole system relatively quickly unraveled.
You've written that at the birth of the modern world, something went wrong with the food system. What was that?
In the modern world, we've made the same three mistakes that the Romans made and the Mayans made. And that first mistake is that we, too, have come to depend on fertile topsoil. And we have ignored the fact that the topsoil is eroding. Now, we've masked our problems with topsoil with chemical fertilizer, but that just swaps one dependency for another. The second mistake we've made is the fact that we've come to depend on harvests which we get from relatively nice climates. And the late 20th century was pretty good, generally speaking, for growing seasons, say between 1930 and 1990. There were no major climactic shocks in the world's bread baskets. Things are likely, however, to change. The third mistake we've made in the modern age, which is also echoes the historic antecedents, is that we have caused our farmers to grow economically efficient by specializing in one or two products. And while this makes wonderful economic sense, it's terrible ecology.
I mean, it's hard to imagine, certainly in developed countries, that, you know, I don't know, there could ever be a kind of an Irish potato famine again. I mean, are you suggesting that something like that could happen? I mean, that we could be headed in that direction?
I don't think there will be a famine in American supermarkets anytime soon. I think that the problem is much more complicated and possibly much more insidious. So, for example, let's imagine a bad drought in northern China. Or, for example, Russia, which we're just experiencing right now. I can see that causing a country like China to suddenly buy up most of the world's rice supplies, which, given that there's not a huge amount of rice traded, wouldn't be that hard for a country like China to do that. So if China starts buying up a lot of wheat and a lot of rice, then I can imagine, say, countries like the Philippines or Thailand, which normally export to, say, the Middle East or East Africa, suddenly stopping selling to those markets and selling to China. I can then that see causing a major subsistence crisis linked with increased food inflation in already politically volatile parts of the world. And that's setting off urban migration, migration across national borders, and increased disease threats as poor, hungry, malnourished people start coming in contact with each other and moving long distances. And then that starts creating a cascading effect. And the ensuing hysteria, political hysteria, could then cause a very, very serious problem for the global food system.
Is there a country that is doing it right today? I mean, is there a sort of a model, I guess, food empire out there right now?
at the country level, most of us are completely invested in this global food system, which is built on some very, very rickety pillars. I think, however, there's a lot of interesting stuff that goes on more at a municipal level with farmers markets, community-supported agriculture, with food policy councils, which are springing up all over cities and towns in Canada and in the U.S. And these are really talking about trying to shorten supply chains, create a level of food sovereignty at a local level, invest in things like soup kitchens and community kitchens, which act as an insurance policy against food shocks for economically poor people. So I think the most innovative stuff is actually happening at a small scale across North America, and there's very little attention to this issue being placed at a national or international scale.
That's Evan Fraser. He teaches geography at the University of Guelph in Ontario, Canada, and he's the co-author of the book Empires of Food, Feast, Famine, and the Rise and Fall of Civilizations. Evan Fraser, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
This week, a federal judge in Richmond refused to dismiss a lawsuit filed by the state of Virginia that challenges the new health care law, handing the law's foes an early legal victory. Virginia's attorney general is hardly alone in opposing the new measure. 20 states are also contesting it. Virginia is one of the leaders in the fight to oppose the mandate that everyone get health insurance. Yet I couldn't help thinking about the photos I saw last week of the long lines of people waiting for what has become an annual event in southwestern Virginia, a mobile health clinic that provides care at the Wise County Fairgrounds. Officials say the remote area medical clinic treated nearly 2,400 people over 3 days. Many had to be turned away. I found this striking because once upon a time, I knew those types of people. They came to our back door, to my stepfather's clinic and 14-bed hospital in rural southeastern Wisconsin. When the patients couldn't pay cash, he accepted barter trade, buckets of blueberries, baskets of corn, pecks of tomatoes. These were the working people you saw around town. The farmers, cooks, home repair tradesmen, and doctors wouldn't think not to provide for them if they could. When I was a girl, the bond between the sick and the healthy was substantial. You got sick or hurt, and of course your brethren found some way to take care of you. Most doctors would never barter for their services today. Insurance laws have changed, medicine has changed, and how we provide health care has become a bitter partisan issue. But the need hasn't changed. The Health Wagon, a group that organized the remote medical clinic in Virginia, says many of the people who come have chronic health problems. Many don't have any access to specialists. A journalist friend who reported on the Virginia event says he spotted a man with a tumor as large as a grapefruit on his back. The man hoped he might find a doctor who could remove it. A man who appeared to be in his late 30s had the remainder of his teeth pulled. He told my friend that he would be gumming it like my papa and not getting any dentures. And the desperate need for health care isn't just in rural areas. A free clinic like the one in Virginia would probably draw crowds anywhere in the U.S. That's what happened this week in Washington, D.C. Nearly 2,000 people showed up for a similar event hosted by the National Association of Free Clinics at the city's downtown convention center. The pictures from Wise County, Virginia, and from Washington remind us that we are all mortal clay, and sooner or later we'll need help. And very few of us will be able to pay that debt with buckets of blueberries. You're listening to NPR News.
Thank you.
Another body of water has drawn the attention of scientists and environmentalists, the Chesapeake Bay in Maryland and Virginia. The eastern oyster once dominated the bay. Now it's barely hanging on. The state of Maryland is drawing up plans to set aside 25% of all oyster habitats in the bay as permanent sanctuaries where harvesting would be banned. Experts say that if oysters can just be left alone, they might start to come back, along with a bunch of other creatures. Sabri Benashour of member station WAMU recently visited an oyster sanctuary to find out more.
Under the murky water of the Severn River in Maryland, just off the Chesapeake Bay, divers are searching the bottom. They report back over an intercom.
It's not too bad. It's the Severn.
They're looking for the oysters they planted 5 years ago. The water is cloudy, and they spend a few minutes looking around. There was a time when this water was crystal clear, and when you didn't have to search for oysters, you could practically trip over them. In fact, early explorers considered them a navigation hazard. When he sailed the bay in 1607, John Smith wrote that the reefs were so high they stuck out of the water. But by 1920, three-quarters of the bay's reefs had been wrenched from the water and harvested for meat. Old photos show piles of shells hundreds of feet high. Even so, there used to be a few places where oysters still thrived, even 40 years ago. Mutt Merritt is a biologist. His lab at Horn Point hatched the oysters the divers are looking for now.
When I was a kid, oyster reefs were everywhere. Back in 72 or so, the minute I put my head underwater, I was in about 30 feet of water, I could see oysters on the bottom. It's just very different out there now.
Things got really bad when diseases carried by ships from abroad started to wipe them out. Runoff from farms and cities buried the survivors in sediment. Pollution just made things worse. Now the population is just a small fraction of what it used to be. Back on the bottom of the river, the divers have found something.
All right, we got them.
They come up to the surface with volleyball-sized clusters of oysters. Stephanie Westbay is a fisheries scientist with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation.
You can see now they've grown into these really big, healthy clumps of oysters. A few dead oysters, but virtually all of them are alive.
And a lot of other creatures came up with the bits of reef. They slither out from the nooks and crevices in between the shells.
And if you look carefully on the deck here, you can see all kinds of worms and mud crabs and some little shrimp kicking around and that kind of thing.
By offering a place to live and hide to those creatures, the reef creates food for bigger creatures.
Striped bass, blue crabs, a variety of fish that feed on them.
Bruce Goldbrow directs the fisheries program with the Chesapeake Bay Foundation.
So you're actually fueling the food web, because then you get a lot more of those fish that we actually catch and have economic value for us.
He says in other sanctuaries, the reefs have attracted fish like black sea bass, which haven't been seen in the bay for decades. The mollusks are also little water treatment plants, filtering the water and keeping it clear so underwater plants can grow.
So that's why the reef community itself is not just about having a pile of oysters, but it's about restoring the functioning of the whole ecosystem.
Maryland's Department of Natural Resources will finalize its new sanctuaries in September. The idea is to fill them with oysters and then leave them alone. A lot is riding on the plan. Watermen are skeptical and worried this will make it harder to make a living. But with all of the oysters' problems, scientists say the sanctuaries are the last best hope these creatures have. For NPR News, I'm Sabri Benashour.
Listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden. This week, a federal judge in Virginia allowed that state's challenge to the Obama health care law to move ahead in court. But the legal dispute experts are really watching is in Florida, where 19 other states have filed court papers intensifying their fight to overturn the law on a much wider set of arguments. NPR's Carrie Johnson reports.
To opponents of the new federal health care plan, the law represents a groundbreaking power grab by the federal government, one that should be fought all the way up to the Supreme Court. And they've got the sweeping rhetoric down already.
This case is about power, accountability, and about the future of our unique federalist system.
That's David Rivkin. He's a lawyer who's helping Florida in 20 other states. They've banded together with a business group and small business owners who are suing to throw out the entire health care law. The arguments revolve around the same issue, whether the federal government is overreaching into the lives of people and industry.
We feel that the statute, if sustained, would not just produce extremely bad results in the health care sector. It would fundamentally warp our constitutional architecture.
Florida's lawsuit targets the individual mandate. It's a requirement that people buy health insurance or pay a penalty. Opponents argue that Congress overstepped its authority under the Constitution's Commerce Clause. The Commerce Clause usually comes into play when Congress wants to regulate economic activity. But in the health care law, Congress moved to exert control over people's failure to act, in this case, to buy insurance.
The opponents say this is regulation of inactivity, and that's not right.
Rob Weiner is leading the government's effort to defend the health care law.
What it is everybody is going to need medical services, virtually everybody, and they're going to have to pay for them. And this regulates how you pay for them.
The Obama administration says taxpayers are on the hook for $43 billion each year in medical bills, racked up by people who have no insurance. Weiner says that's more than enough to trigger the federal government's interest in regulating this economic activity. And the administration says if states don't like the new law, they can just opt out of federal insurance programs like Medicaid.
Congress is appropriating billions of dollars that it's providing to the states for Medicaid, and it's entitled to attach conditions to the billions of dollars that it provides.
The states say it's not so easy to walk away from Medicaid, and there's no clear way to sever those ties, even if they wanted to. A judge will hear the arguments when both sides face off in court in Florida in September. And while it's been 5 months since President Obama signed his top domestic priority into law, national polls suggest the political divide persists. Robert Blendon studies health policy and politics at Harvard.
It's very partisan divisions. We're overwhelmingly Democrats like this bill, think it's one of the great things for the country, and overwhelmingly Republicans think this bill is a terrible mistake. And in fact, the polls that asked about repeal show most Republicans favoring some sort of repeal or replace.
The most contentious aspect of the law, the individual mandate, doesn't take effect until 2014. The future of health care, Blendon says, could be subject to plenty of political changes before then, like two congressional elections and a presidential race. Carrie Johnson, NPR News, Washington.
The recession is over, but the American job machine is stuck in neutral. That's the message from the government's labor report for July. Yesterday, President Barack Obama addressed the disappointing jobs numbers.
Climbing out of any recession, much less a hole as deep as this one, takes some time. The road to recovery doesn't follow a straight line.
Private sector jobs grew by just 71,000 last month, but those gains were wiped out by the layoff of temporary census workers. And Frank Langfitt, NPR's labor reporter, joins us here in our studios to explain where the job market is just months before midterm elections. Hello there, Frank.
Hi, Jackie.
So the economy has been growing slowly for months, but jobs just aren't bouncing back. What's going on?
It's classic jobless recovery. I mean, we had some growth from government stimulus earlier on. Last year, we had that cash for clunkers bill. So that drove people to buy more cars. That helped the economy. We had a first-time homebuyer tax credit, but that expired in the spring. And so right now, there's just not a lot of real consumer demand to drive jobs. People also feel a lot less wealthy than they did after the real estate bubble burst, and they're hoarding cash they're not spending. So if you're a business person right now, you look out there, you're kind of reluctant to hire a lot more people until you see strong demand for your products.
Were there any bright spots whatsoever in this report?
There are a few. I mean, the average work week is growing, and that's good because what businesses often do is they will add hours to their current workers before they hire new workers. So that trend is headed in the right direction. And as you mentioned at the beginning, there was private sector job growth. The auto sector, which had a really, really rough year last year, has improved. So is healthcare. But a lot of those gains were also offset by big losses in state and local government because their budgets are in real trouble and they're cutting back.
A lot of people still left behind. So on a human level, how does a sluggish job market like this affect the millions of people who remain unemployed?
Dramatically. You know, most of the lost jobs were through no fault of the people who lost them. This was a man-made recession. It started with that reckless mortgage lending that we spent a lot of time talking about in 2007, the crazy risks that were taken on Wall Street. And a lot of people out there have been unemployed for a long time. They're really frustrated. They can't find work. And we're seeing that in some of the numbers. For instance, you know, the economy has actually grown for a whole year. But at the same time, the number of discouraged workers, these are people who are no longer looking for work because they don't think there's anything out there for them, has actually gone up nearly 400,000. So even as the economy grows, more people are actually losing hope.
After the labor report came out yesterday, President Obama visited a sign-making company in Washington, D.C., and he talked about the slow pace of job growth.
For America's workers, families, and small businesses, progress needs to come faster. Our job is to make sure that happens.
Frank, as we know, the midterm elections are in November. So what kind of effect could the market have on the president and his party?
Considerable. You know, the economy is the biggest issue out there, and you now have more than 14 million people out of work. Many of them are expected to take their frustration out on incumbents, especially Democrats. And economists, looking at the labor market going forward, they don't see a lot of improvement anytime soon. So between now and November, we're probably not going to see any sort of bump that's going to be terribly meaningful for voters. So the outlook for President Obama and the Democrats in Congress looks increasingly tough.
Will depend on whether those people vote, I suppose.
Indeed.
Frank Langfitt is NPR's labor reporter. Thank you again.
You're welcome.